on the Jewish calendar is the ninth of Av. The ninth of Av, Tisha B'Av, and it is a prominent date on the Jewish calendar. Today, the ninth of Av is the memorial day for the destruction of the temple. How many temples have there been in Jerusalem?
Two.
Not three yet. I once knew someone who said, I heard him asked what he thought about the coming third temple, and he said, I think we should skip that one and go right to the fourth. I thought that was kind of funny. Anyway, there's been two temples, and which one of them was destroyed on the ninth of Av? Both, actually. The Babylonians destroyed the first temple on the ninth of Av, and then about 650 years later, the second one was destroyed on the same day by the Romans. The Romans had breached the city walls, the Babylonians, 3 weeks earlier, and then the temple was burned on the ninth of Av. Both temples destroyed on the same day. Throughout Jewish history, it's interesting that other disasters Jewish disasters have occurred on this date as well. I mentioned last week the expulsion of the Jewish people from Spain happened to be the ninth of Av. The expulsion of the Jews from the British Empire in 1290 was on the ninth of Av. There were no Jews allowed, at least legally, in Britain until about 350 years later, when Oliver Cromwell invited the Jews to return. There's an interesting story with that that maybe we'll check out on another occasion. World War I began in 1914 on the ninth of Av. And indeed, World War II was just the conclusion to World War I with a 20-year ceasefire in the middle. And we know what destruction that brought for Israel. The destruction of the temple, the first temple, according to the prophets, was based on three things. Based on murder, immorality, and idolatry. Murder and idols. The prophets speak endlessly. Isaiah, Jeremiah speak about how under every tree, on every hill, there are cultic shrines. The first temple was destroyed, according to the prophets, for idolatry, for murder, for immorality. The second temple period was marked by a resurgence, a strength of loyalty to the Most High. Idolatry didn't happen in the same measure in the Second Temple period as the first. And so the Jewish literature questions, why would the Second Temple have been destroyed? Why was the Second Temple destroyed? And the answer in the Jewish literature is equally astonishing. The conclusion was because of baseless hatred. because of hatred one for another, the second temple was destroyed. And of course, Yeshua links the two, hatred and murder. Because of doing wrong, God had warned in the prophets over and over, there is going to ultimately be a consequence to the wrong lifestyle that one is living and walking in. Doing evil will bring suffering and persecution. We see this in the observance of the ninth day of the month of Av. By the way, since today is a Sabbath, the observance of the ninth of Av is put off until the following day. The same for any day of sorrow and mourning or so forth in Jewish tradition. Those things are actually lifted and not observed on the Sabbath. In this case, on this particular year, it's put off observance until Sunday, the following day. 1 Peter chapter 3 says something very interesting about suffering. 1 Peter chapter 3 says, why would you want to suffer for doing something wrong? You don't want to suffer for doing something wrong. But 1 Peter turns this whole idea of suffering, why one would suffer, on its head and takes it in an entirely new direction. Peter says, all of you, be harmonious, sympathetic, tender-hearted, and humble with each other. Do not repay evil for evil or insult for insult, but give a blessing instead. For this is the reason you were called, so that you might inherit a blessing. Because the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayer, but the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. Who is going to harm you if you are eager for doing good? But even if you should suffer for what is right, you are blessed. Do not be afraid or worry about their threats. Instead, sanctify the Messiah as Lord in your hearts. Always be ready to give an answer to anyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is within you. Why would you want to suffer for doing good? Verse 17, for it is better to suffer for doing good than to suffer for doing evil. 1 Peter is going to present the idea that it is possible to suffer not just for doing evil. We see that in the prophets. We see that in Tish B'Av. But it is also possible to suffer for doing good, as astonishing as that might seem. In fact, when Yeshua first mentions this to his disciples, that the Messiah will suffer because he is the Messiah, the Talmidim, Yeshua's students, don't know how to take this. Peter actually says, no, actually, you're wrong, Yeshua. You got this all mixed up. You don't understand suffering. You suffer for doing wrong. We know what the prophets say, but Yeshua actually, in some actually pretty strong language, tells Peter to cut it, stop it. And in fact, he tells Peter not only will the Messiah suffer because he is the Messiah, but his followers will suffer as well, will suffer for doing good. I'm going to go to Acts chapter 7, and then in a little bit I'm going to come back to 1 Peter to connect us to something in the Torah. Acts chapter 7, it's in the reading of this week's Brit HaKadoshah portion, beginning in verse 51. This cuts right into the middle of the story of a man who is known by a Greek name, Stephen, and he has been hauled into a Jewish court and been asked to give an account for his faithfulness to the Messiah. We pick up in verse 51, and here Stephen is talking like a prophet. He says, "You stiff-necked people." By the way, do you remember the first time in Scripture that the term stiff-necked occurred? When was Israel first called? Exodus 32, which is in the context of what? The golden calf. The golden calf story is the first time that this phrase about being stiff-necked occurs. So when Stephen throws this accusation at you hard-headed people, essentially, people unable to hear, he's accusing them of being idolaters. You stiff-necked people. So obviously they're not going to like what he has to say. You uncircumcised of heart and ears. That's prophet language, Moses language as well. You always resist Ruach HaKodesh, the spirit of holiness, just as your fathers did. You do as well. Which of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? They killed the ones who foretold the coming of the righteous one. Now you have become his betrayers and murderers. You receive the Torah by the direction of angels, but you don't keep it. When they heard these things, they became enraged and they began gnashing their teeth at him. But Stephen, full of Ruach HaKodesh, gazed into heaven and saw the glory of God and Yeshua standing like a judge at the right hand of God. And he said, "Look, I see the heavens open and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God." But they covered their ears and, crying out in a loud voice, rushed at him with one impulse. Driving him out of the city, they began stoning him. Although the Romans were the judicial and governmental authority, the Roman eagle loomed large over Jerusalem at that time. The Jewish court did not actually have the right to put anyone to death without Roman sanction. And in fact, Jewish tradition tells us that the Sanhedrin only very infrequently ever put anyone to death. The tradition is that maybe once a generation that the Sanhedrin actually executed anyone. But here we have a story of them responding out of anger and emotion. They pushed Stephen out of Jerusalem and they began stoning him. And witnesses laid their cloaks at the feet of a young man named Shaul. And they went on stoning Stephen as he was crying out, "Lord Yeshua, receive my spirit." It, of course, echoes what Luke earlier in the Besorah Gospel, chapter 22, says of Yeshua. When Yeshua cried out, "Lord, receive my spirit," Stephen is in good company in his words and his actions. Then he fell on his knees and he cried out in a loud voice, "Lord, do not hold this sin against them." And he died. According to Jewish literature, when one was being executed, they were to confess their sin. This is actually still true in Jewish custom to this day. When one is on their deathbed, they make a confession. They confess their sins to the Most High as a final purging, final purification of their heart. So a criminal would confess their sins. I guess even in our culture, this is common. You know, you give the condemned criminal in states where they have the death penalty, give them the opportunity to make a last statement. It's kind of interesting sometimes to hear what they choose to say on those occasions. The same was true in Jewish culture at that time, to confess their sins. But isn't it interesting that Stephen does not confess his sins, he confesses their sins. Lord, don't hold their sins against them. Yeshua had done the same thing when he died at the hands of the Romans on the stake. Lord, don't hold their sins against them. Stephen is cutting against the tradition of the time, not confessing his sins, but turning it around, confessing the sins of those that are executing him. Now, Shaul was in agreement with Stephen's execution. And on that very day, a great persecution arose against Messiah's community in Jerusalem. That very day. So imagine this. The mob of Jewish leaders that had executed Stephen draws more attention. And then they lash out not only against has happened for Stephen, but then they begin attacking, we're told, both men and women who are Jewish believers there in Jerusalem. We go from a random angry execution to mob violence against Messiah's community in Jerusalem. And the believers were scattered throughout the region of Judea and Samaria. We're told that some devout men buried Stephen and mourned deeply for him. There's another interesting thing here that Jewish tradition, Jewish literature particularly, speaks about. To mourn the dead, to bury the dead, is actually one of the greatest of the mitzvot. After all, how can the dead return any kindness or make any response for you burying them? Well, that's why burying the dead is among the greatest act of mercy and kindness and goodness that someone can do. Because there is no way possibly that you can be rewarded by the person that you have served in this way. Except in one exception. Jewish tradition, Jewish literature that is, forbade the burial and mourning of a criminal. Criminals were not to be mourned. I guess it had some impact on the continuing the idea of remembering this person's deed and not maybe it had a deterrent effect, I suppose, perhaps. If they are not to be mourned, you might be less willing to repeat their action. But I love the way it says that these devout, godly individuals, the Hebrew idea here is perhaps that they are righteous. They are hasadim. They are righteous ones, Jewish believers, who go and defy the tradition and mourn for Stephen. I'm interested in the way that the people act and respond in this story. A young man named Shaul stands there knowingly, with understanding. He is taking a lot in to his spirit. We see that he himself is going to become a lead persecutor. He's going to become, in his mind, a zealous prophet, uprooting idolatry. Contrast that with Stephen, who has the heart for the Most High, that in his moment of execution, the last words on his lips are words of forgiveness for those that seek to take and destroy him. Indeed, we're told, Saul, Shaul, was destroying Messiah's community, entering house after house, dragging off men and women, we're told, and he was throwing them in prison. But those who were scattered went around proclaiming the word of Yeshua. All this had an amazing effect on culture and society. Stephen was persecuted. It immediately led to mob violence in Jerusalem, where other Jewish believers were attacked, or at least rounded up and put into prison. Shaul had stood by and watched Stephen's execution. But evidently, before the day was over, he was leading groups rounding up Jewish believers and at least imprisoning them. We don't know what else was happening. Jewish believers literally were running for their lives. Not all left Jerusalem. The text tells us that the Shlechim, Yaakov, Peter, John, others evidently remained in Jerusalem. But we're told that believers from Jerusalem here and later, we're told that they spread to Samaria, to Antioch, to Pontus, and other areas, not only in the land, but outside of the land. Antioch was a city up the coast from where present-day Haifa is at. And there is going to be an amazing experience that happens with believers, Jewish believers that fled from Jerusalem, running to avoid persecution, but where they flee, there the life and the presence of God goes with them. They suffer not for doing wrong, as in the story of Tisha B'Av. They suffer for doing right. They suffer for doing the right thing. Once again, in the words of Peter in chapter 3 where we started, Kepha said, "Do not repay evil for evil. Don't repay evil for evil when you are persecuted for righteousness' sake." But give a blessing instead. Okay, it's one thing for Kepha to tell these Messianic Jews that he's writing to, don't repay evil for evil. You know, how would you say, in the words of the civil rights movement, nonviolent demonstration? Don't repay evil for evil, attack for attack. But he really takes that and he pushes it even farther. He says, but give a blessing instead. Yeshua had said, pray for those who persecute you. And I want to take, you know, the book and hit my head. Okay, of course, I don't want to do that to my Bible, so I won't. But it's like, God, are you kidding me? It's one thing to try to control my spirit and my emotions and say, okay, I won't respond. I can't respond in a hateful, belligerent way. But yet, it's really so much more to say, God, I'm not just going to be not react, but I'm going to be proactive. I'm going to give a blessing. It says, don't repay evil for evil or insult for insult, but give a blessing instead. Because it is for this reason you were called. It is for this reason you were called, so that you might inherit a blessing. What did God tell Abraham in Genesis chapter 12? What? That's right. Very good. God told Abraham, I'm going to bless you. And the purpose of that blessing is so that you can be a blessing. You are to bless all the families of the earth. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. Have you ever read that carefully and recognized that God promised Abraham that there would be people that didn't like him? I will bless those who bless you, and we like that part. But God said, there will also be people who will respond with antagonism, insult, or worse. As I've said in other presentations, in other contexts, God warned the first Hebrew about anti-Semitism. Although anti-Semitism, the phrase, wasn't coined until the very late 19th century, it's been around as long as Abraham. God warned Abraham that there would be a response. Different kinds of response. One favorably, but there would also be those that would have a response of persecution. Abraham didn't have to suffer Stephen's fate, as I pray that you and I don't in our lives, as so many do around the world, it seems, year after year, generation after generation. It's interesting that Peter says, don't repay evil for evil, insult for insult. Instead, give a blessing. What does he mean, give a blessing? Because you've been called to do this. I think Peter is referring to Genesis chapter 12. Because God said, there will be those, Abraham, that curse you and persecute you. And what did God do? How did God tell Abraham to deal with that? Have you ever thought about this? God says, I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. He didn't say, Abraham, you can curse those who curse you. He didn't say, Abraham, you can attack or be belligerent to those that are belligerent with you. That is, for righteousness' sake. God said, I will curse. In a very similar passage in Romans 12, Rav Shaul, by the way, that same persecutor, said this. He said, vengeance is mine, says the Lord. He quotes Torah and applies it to this idea of persecution. When believers are persecuted, kind of like the way he used to, he says, God will respond. Abraham, God told him, I will curse those who curse you. And then the next verse says, and all the families of the earth will be blessed through you. So even in the midst of the cursing, Abraham, keep being a blessing. Keep being a blessing. This is why Kepha can say, instead of responding evil for evil, respond with a blessing. Give a blessing. Because this is why you have been called. This has to do with your calling. Your calling in Abraham. And then only a few verses later it says, you know, we're going to suffer. You can suffer for doing wrong, like Tish B'Av, or you can suffer for doing right. Yeshua said, you can gain your life and lose it, or you can lose your life and gain it. And either way, you lose. But we get to choose how to lose. Kepha says it's better to suffer for doing right than to suffer for doing wrong. Later in the book of Peter, in his writing to those messianic communities, he says, actually, your sufferings are united with the sufferings of Messiah. We're not suffering on our own. We suffer with the Messiah. He is present in our pain. He is present in the persecution. He's present in the comments from your coworkers, from the neighbor. I remember the antagonism that I felt when I was in junior high. Because people knew that I was a believer. People knew that my best friend and I had started a prayer gathering before school each morning. Some people found it goofy, found it odd, found it funny to kind of make jokes. And sometimes our suffering for Messiah will be even more costly than that. I really have a new admiration for Stephen. He was willing to say it straight. So somehow I'm sure he knew that his words couldn't help but draw a response. But he responds to persecution in the same way that Abraham was told to respond. He responds in a way to persecution in the same way that Kefa later taught. Don't return evil for evil or even insult for insult. Instead, leave a blessing, because this is why we have been called. On Tisha B'Av, when we remember the loss, the exiles in our life due to persecution, I pray that we, if we're going to have to live in exile, I pray that our exile is based because we are doing the right thing, not because we are doing the wrong thing. And may God give us strength as a community to teach us, not only in our community, but across Messianic Judaism, what it means to be a follower of the Messiah in a world that doesn't understand at best and isn't going to like it sometimes as well, but that we would learn and understand what it means to be anointed Jewish and Gentile followers of the Messiah. May we respond like Abraham, like Yeshua, like Stephen,